Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Out of the gate.
You know why?
That was weird.
Because you probably don't recognize me, but I'm on time this week.
You are on time. You are on time. Congratulations.
So, you know what? You know what? I came so early on the show that I had time to just like do... I could have run...
Well, you were like 10 minutes late last week.
Yes. So I made up for it. I was 15 minutes
late. Did you get
early.
In trouble for that?
I did.
Who yelled at you?
My dad yelled at me. He even called me today. He's like, you're going to be on time? I'm like, I'm going to be on time. I'm going to be on time. You know? How was your week?
It was okay.
I'm going to start calling you Edward every now and then.
My name's not Edward.
Really? Every Eddie I know is an Edward.
No, I'm an Edwin.
Oh, an Edwin. Mm-hmm. Oh. Can I call you Edwin?
No.
Please?
That's why I go by Eddie.
I never knew that you were an Edwin.
Mm-hmm. I'm an Edwin.
That's so adorable. Yeah. How was your week? What'd you do?
What'd I do? I've been getting in political fights with my brother all week, which is a bad idea.
I just read one of your posts.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe he was a Pence. I was like, oh, man. How are these two related? I was going to ask you. How did he vote for Trump?
I don't know.
Man.
I don't know. Just people are different. I guess. I don't know.
How much older is he than you?
He's younger. He's 2 years younger.
So you should be taking him under your wing. Wait, where does he live? Is he still in Virginia?
He's back in Virginia. Yeah.
That has a lot to do with it.
So I don't know. What are you going to do? People are different. I don't know. I can't make
sense of it. So you just give up? Do you give up on those debates?
I try not to engage that much because I've just been doing things on Twitter, like, since the inauguration. I don't do anything just bashing. What I'll do is I'll just talk about how the day before was so much better than today. Dude, like, hey, let's look on the bright side.
That was the post I read of you.
But that's what I've been doing on Twitter, like, the last 4 days. I was just like, hey, remember how great it was yesterday? all I do.
You know, it's crazy to me that he just keeps on sinking the ship. He just makes bad decisions.
I know. This isn't a political show.
No, it's okay. We can talk. We don't talk about it all the time. We're in the world of entertainment, but, you know, of course we're going to have a little
I understand why he got so popular, because he was an outsider. I got that. And people wanted something different in D.C. I got that. I can see how he rose to popularity. But to what he's done since he's been in for 4 days has done everything a corporate politician would
do. Totally.
And not just a Republican, a corporate Democrat, too. Corporate, any sort of politician, that's all he's done, is done what would enhance corporations, which is what...
Oh, yeah, studio audience.
So I don't know where you're coming from with, I was an outsider and I'm going to bring everything back to the people, when you're doing everything that seems to be geared towards corporations.
Well, I mean, the president, unfortunately, is somewhat of a puppet. But you really see who's pulling the strings with Trump.
Yeah,
it's very clear. You know, there's the weird. You know, the voter that I am most perplexed by is the middle class Republican. I'm like, why are you voting for Trump when he is not anywhere near going to support anything that you're?
I don't know.
We should bring your brother on as a guest.
No, we should not.
You know what we should do? I'll tell you what we should do.
I try not to engage because it's frustrating.
My brother's hardcore about politics. Your brother is in a totally opposite view of politics. We should have our brothers have a debate.
Oh, God, no.
That would be awesome. Just to see what would happen. I like it.
No, I don't like doing it. I hate talking about it.
I'm sorry.
It's awful.
That sucks. We saw Mel Brooks, though. We got to see
Oh, that was true. We did see that. We saw the Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, we saw a live Q&A with Mel Brooks.
I can't believe how sharp he is for a 90-year-old man.
I was
so crazy.
Yeah, and he's 90 years old, and it's like the amount of energy he has.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even have that energy at 38. And he's just like jumping up, like can't wait. He's like brimming with energy and just hilarious stories. His memory is sharp.
Sharp memory. I mean, just quick with everything, too, with the comma. I mean, he was amazing.
Yeah.
I hope I'm that way at 90.
Dude, I don't think I'm going to be that way at 40.
Yeah,
seriously. But it was awesome to see the movie. And you know what? For me, it was awesome to see the movie with the sound being the way it was, mm-hmm. and also to see it in a theater and get that audience response.
Yeah. Because I think it's the first time I saw it in a theater. I think, yeah, that's probably the first time I ever saw a theater display of it.
The first Mel Brooks movie I saw in a theater was Spaceballs.
Yeah, probably me too.
And I remember just the response from the audience. But Blazing Saddles, you know, it says a lot about a movie when you watch a movie like that by yourself. And you're just like, oh my God, this is so racy. This is so awesome. This is so crazy. And the weird thing is that movie would it's true. They said it, you know, that night. But
oh yeah, there's
never
no way.
Be made.
You couldn't make movies that were made in the 90s today. I mean, some movies were made in the 90s. Some movies were made in the 80s. You couldn't make today. I'm just.
Yeah, it's a little tame now. And you know what? You know what's cool? Like, I never knew that Mel Brooks was friends with Richard Pryor. You knew all this backstory.
Yeah.
Which I had no idea that Richard Pryor was supposed to be in Blazing Saddles.
He wrote it.
I know. I had no idea. And I had no idea, too, that he was friends with Alfred Hitchcock. Like that. It was just like a collision of so many different kind of vibes in Hollywood that I was just like, man, it's not like that now. It's just does
well,
not
back seem then, like, I mean, back in the 50s, I mean, you still had the studio days. So, I mean, people were locked into their different studios, so they were always like on the studio lot. I mean, Hitchcock had like a house on the Universal lot. I mean, they lived there, and so they all commingled. I mean, it was just
that was the day.
It was a different. Now everything is so independent and freelance, which is great, but at the same time, it's not the same as it was. I mean, it's.
I got to send you the link. There's a link of him talking about Young Frankenstein. And how he says that right before he left the meeting, when they were like, we're excited about you doing the movie, he said, oh, by the way, I'm going to shoot this in black and white.
And walked out.
I mean, he's just awesome. Yeah. And he's still like that. You know, it was.
And that movie's great because it's black and white.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a spoof on horror, on ancient old horror movies. It has to be black and white.
I'm nervous about Spaceballs 2, but.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be good.
But you know what? If it's Mel Brooks, I'm sure he'll have some part of it that's going to be awesome. You know?
I don't know. I still try to find a part of Robin Hood Men in Tights that's redeemable, and I can't.
Well, Dave Chappelle's in it. I mean, that's
still not good.
It's not the best movie. It's not the best comedy.
But
there's some scenes that are all right.
His body of work is ridiculous. Anyway,
what's your favorite Mel Brooks movie?
Young Frankenstein.
All time.
Huh. I mean, I love Blazing Saddles because it's the first Mel Brooks movie I saw. But for some reason, Young Frankenstein, Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein just kills me.
For me, it was definitely Spaceballs, so only because I remember seeing all the Star Wars movies,
mm-hmm.
and then seeing that and seeing it just over the top. You know,
I remember seeing Spaceballs in the theater and being so excited to go see it because I was such a huge Star Wars fan, and not liking it as much as I wanted to like it when I saw it.
Why?
It just didn't. I didn't feel like it was as funny as I thought it was going to be. And then after you get it at home on a VHS and you watch it 5,000 times,
like, okay,
and awesome. You start memorizing the lines, you start doing lines with your buddies, then it becomes a funnier movie. But I remember watching it and being a little let down in the theater just because I was so excited
for it. Well, you'd seen Blazing Saddles, so you probably had high expectations going into it. I had not seen any.
Oh, you never seen,
movie.
Yeah. I grew up on Blazing Saddles. Like, I saw Blazing Saddles at an age I probably shouldn't have seen Blazing Saddles. I probably saw it when I was like 6 or 7 years old.
But the great thing about a movie like that is when you see it later in life, you catch jokes that you did not.
Oh, I didn't understand half of what I was being said when I saw it the first time. And that's the great thing with that movie is, like, I kept rediscovering that movie as I got older because I kept getting more and more of the jokes.
It's such a great movie.
Because when you're a kid, you don't get any of them.
Yeah.
You laugh at the physical stuff, the broad comedy.
I love that scene where they're like, oh, shoot, does anybody have any dimes?
Yeah.
Let's go back
and get a shitload of dimes.
Yeah, there's just like little clever things that he did that were just awesome. Little just racial things also. Yeah.
Like, I didn't know. When I was a kid watching that and she turned the lights off, I was like, is it what they say, how you people are gifted? It's true. Like, I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And then they pulled out the Schnitzelgruben in the next scene. I'm like, oh, they're talking about hot dogs. Like, because you're a kid, that's what you think. And then you get older and you're like, oh, that's not what they're talking about.
But that's what makes the movie timeless. Yeah. You know, it's like, but the crazy thing is to know that how sharp he was about details about the movie. Like, the audition. I mean, that movie was 40 years ago. You know what I mean? Something like that. So it's just crazy that he was so sharp in the memory of making it, you know? And even that time when he made it, I think when he made it, he didn't think it was going to be this cult classic.
I don't think anybody thinks.
Yeah.
I mean, you hope it's going to be great, but at the same time, I don't think when you're making it, you think it's going to be, like, some classic film.
There's one thing I really admire him, and he said it about Young Frankenstein, but he really said it about Blazing Saddles, and I was like, you're such a badass, Mel Brooks. He sat down and he got notes from the head of the studio, And the guy just gave him note after note after note. And he's sitting there playing the game, and he's writing all the notes, like totally like brown-nosing the guy. And then he just crumpled the paper and threw it in
the
trash.
Yeah, but he could. Like, he had Final Cut.
Yeah, but
you don't get that doesn't happen anymore.
I know, but he was smart.
Of course he was brilliant to do that.
Yeah.
But back then you could do that. I mean, that wasn't unheard of to get Final Cut as a director. Now it's just like, especially a studio movie like that, it's like impossible.
Who was I don't even know the last director that's gotten Final Cut for a movie.
On a movie like on a large scale studio movie, I don't know. I don't even know.
That'd be an interesting fact, because it's like now there's so many suits and corporate, you know, kind of intermingling with
there's so much money involved now. Right. And it's just like there's so much risk, and people like we can't just leave it up to this one guy and his vision. We have
to make. That's like, you know, that's the sad thing about what's happening with art versus commerce. It's like, that is what the point is. We go to see the movies.
True, but
to get that vision.
We love the art and the vision, but at the same time, it's like it costs a lot of money to make that art and vision, and unless you can self-fund it and self-distribute it, then you have to pay heed to these other people's opinions. That's true. The problem.
That's why we're here, though. Speaking of directors, we have a special director with us, Mr. Jorge Valdez-Iga. Our studio audience already loves you just
for
your name alone.
Good for you remembering that name. See? There's no way. I got Jorge, and then the rest of it was just...
How'd I do?
I could not.
How'd I do?
That was pretty good. I was very impressed.
See? Yeah. You see that? I'm bilingual already.
Good for you. I couldn't...
Hey, it's important to me.
I know. It's very important.
You grew up with a name like Nikhil Karula. Knowing somebody's name, you learn, like, okay, I'm not...
Yeah, I grew up with Ed. People call me Ed. It was like, I didn't... Names are like two letters.
Just kidding. So, Jorge, let's talk about your love and passion for film. How did you get involved with this project? I was there. Let's talk a little bit about this movie, and I want to talk a little bit about your previous films too, but let's talk about this movie, I Was There. Let's get right into it.
Thank you. Thank you, Nikhil. Thank you, Eddie, for having me.
Yeah,
of course. See, he said my name right. He knows.
I know it's Edwin, but I will never...
No, thank you, Jorge. I appreciate that.
My middle name is Fernando, so you can make fun of that.
Oh, Fernando.
I like that. Jorge, Fernando Valdez-Iga.
Fernando's got power
to
it.
Like, you should wear a cape. And
I know.
Yeah. You know?
And I tried to use Fernando at some point when I changed countries, but there was already a Fernando in my class. I have to stick with Jorge, which I learned to love afterwards. Fernando's pretty badass.
And you're probably way more successful than that other Fernando, too. So you get the last laugh.
That's right. You just show that other Fernando. Bizarro Fernando.
Yeah. You're the real Fernando.
All right, so there's this movie about 9/11,
yes,
about the survivor, and he's got a little bit of guilt for surviving 9/11, right?
Yes.
So tell us like how you got involved with the story, mm-hmm, how you got involved with the vision of this film. I want to know the every little nitty-gritty part of this.
Okay, sounds good. So the first thing, I was living in New York at the time, and I was taking classes at the Susan Batson Studio, which is one of the best studios in New York City to take classes. It was founded by Carl Ford, who was also in the movie, son of Susan Batson, which is a renowned coach who coaches A-listers, Nicole Kidman, Juliette Binoche.
Yeah, I've heard that name before.
Exactly. So she goes on set with this big actor. So, and she set up the studio, and I went there to learn acting to become a better director. And one of the actors there that was working was James A. Lee. And he was actually teaching at the time. He's acting. He's always acting, but at the time he was teaching there for a little bit. And he called me one day and told me, come over, I want to tell you a story. And he pitched me this story that he had of this firefighter that had survived 9/11. Because he was pulled out of the rubble 3 days after 9/11.
Oh, so he was actually in the rubble. The rubble, he didn't get out before the tower went down. He was actually trapped.
He was trapped in the rubble for 3 days and survived. And it was like a miracle, and everybody made him into a hero. But the story is that, I mean, you know, he became an alcoholic. The movie talks a lot about post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
Many movies just focus on the hero aspect or
survivor's remorse, right?
And you know, we talk about survival's guilt a lot. You know, it's not the same story that we hear about 9/11. It's a fresh approach. And this firefighter actually, the reason that he survived is because he ran away. He was a coward, basically. In his eyes, he was a coward. He ran away. He got scared. And that's the only reason he survived. But nobody knows. So to everybody, he's a hero.
Is that what really happened, or?
That's what happened in the story. It's a fictional story.
Oh, it's a fictional story. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's fiction. Sorry. Yeah, so and this is a story that he told me when he invited me over to his place. And I was like, wow, this is a great story. So I gravitated a lot to it. And we wrote the outline of the story. And by Monday morning, we had a complete thing, the whole story, not the script, but the whole outline of it.
Right.
And it took us like a few weeks to write the script. It was really, really fast. It was in June, and we ended up shooting in August. Sorry, no, that's not true. In September 10th, the day before 9/11. Yeah, it was very important for us to shoot on the day of 9/11 at downtown New York. Wow. So we started production September 10th. But I mean, you can imagine like putting together a script and the crew and everything.
Jeez,
and
man.
Raising the money. And
that's crazy.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was.
I can't even pay my credit card bill on time.
Edwin.
And that's automatic payment.
Yeah. So basically, at the time I was working with Sebastián Zurita, who's a very famous actor in Mexico, on another project that fell through. And I said, you know what, I want to make a movie this summer. I don't care. And I was writing something else at the time when James introduced me to this story. And he had already been working on the project for so long, he had been invested as an actor on it. He was literally, like when we were talking about the story, he was literally just being the actor talking to me. So it was just like, he felt
he was
like
living it.
He was living it. Yeah. He was very method. You know, he comes from a very, very hardcore school of acting. And so I felt like I saw him as a firefighter. I was like, wow, this is amazing. He had this massive beard, you know.
Did he stay in character? Like most method actors stay in character off camera.
Yes.
Was he like that, or did he come back to that place of, I'm okay, I'm real, I'm a human being again?
He's extremely professional, but he definitely stayed in. And like, I know him, I know how he works. So he would go after each take just to his room or wherever we have. We never even have like a trailer or anything. It was like extremely low budget.
Thing. Right.
But he knew to save all that energy away. So it's not like he wouldn't make a mess or something like that. He was very, very respectful of his art and took care of himself. But when he was on set and we shot, he was, you know, ready. He just rolled the camera. Like 9/11, for instance, when we went down to Ground Zero, he had never been on Ground Zero. Even though he got chills. Yeah, he was in New York at the time of the attacks. But he didn't go to Ground Zero because he wanted to go down there as the character that he had worked on, Gus. So when we went down there, like we just took a camera, a small crew, and we just followed him.
So you're getting his initial reactions to the first time ever. Wow.
Yeah, that's heavy. It was very, very heavy.
That's cool.
And it was so real that like camera crews from CNN and other stations actually thought he was a firefighter and like started shooting him because he started crying at the monument or whatever. And we went into an area where there were other firefighters, like real firefighters. He's not a firefighter. But because he was so in character, he went and touched the equipment and he got onto the you know, what's not the van, what's it called? The fire truck.
Fire truck.
But nobody said anything because he was like, they just assumed that he was a
sergeant. Like, oh yeah, this guy's a firefighter. Yeah.
You know, that was how much in he was.
Good thing there wasn't a fire and they had to go somewhere. Like, hey, we need your help. Come on, buddy.
He's like, no, I'm just
no, I'm just
an actor. Not real.
Just to follow through with it and try to put a fire out.
That was a commitment.
I think it's pretty cool that he got on the fire truck. Like, I would have gotten them.
I think it's cool that he was so convincing that the fire people were like, hey, man, get the hell off the fire truck.
That's true.
That's crazy. Because that's like an emotional experience for anyone who's ever been there for the first time just as a human being that knows what happened. But to go there being prepared and all that work you put in as being someone who experienced it.
It's intense.
To take that and be able to catch. That's crazy. That's amazing.
Yeah, he went into the church. We didn't go with the camera into the church, the chapel that held all the firefighters when they were doing the attack. They all run into this chapel that is really close by. I think it's St. Paul's called. It's called St. Paul's, really close. It was very emotional for all of us, and there was quite, I mean, on the day of 9/11, I don't know if you've been on Ground Zero on 9/11.
Mm-mm.
It's packed with people, like massive amounts of people that come to pay tribute, to pay their respects, firefighters, first responders. We have a screening actually this Sunday in New York City, in Brooklyn, at an old firehouse that is now used for events. It's called the Firehouse. Firehouse Space. And
Ingenious.
Genius name.
It's a genius name.
Eddie.
So the Firehouse Space, their website is pretty cool. They have a quote that is right up your alley. I'll show it to you.
We used to be a firehouse.
But it's for first response. The screening is meant for firefighters. It's free for anybody that wants to attend. And we have a donation jar for that. The money will go to a foundation called the Feel Good Foundation that takes care of first responders that are, and anybody else that is has been affected by a 9/11 related injury or illness, respiratory illness, for instance, if you were living in the area.
Yeah.
So John Feel, who is the founder of this foundation, just posted his our movie on his Facebook, and we had like an incredible response from firefighters who saw the trailer. They were very moved by the trailer, and they were like, "Oh, come, we can see the film." And I've been getting emails from firefighters.
That's
from all
amazing.
The area.
Wow.
It's been an incredible
wow.
journey, especially now that we are showing it to firefighters.
What was your budget for the film?
We cannot discuss the budget of the film.
Oh, you can't discuss it?
No. Are you getting into that?
That's so interesting.
No, that's cool.
No, I'll tell you why. Because like we actually did it for very, very, very cheap.
Yeah.
Pulling tons of favors.
Yeah.
I went to Cannes to the Cannes Film Market and I showed the trailer and people were saying, "Oh, it's like $1 million movie, $2 million movie," and I was like, "Yes, it's $1 million movie."
Right.
If they know that we did it for what we did it for, they would offer me half of that or even
right,
right, right, right, right.
So, but the point is that it is a very well produced movie. It has production value, a lot of production value. You know, shooting in 9/11, shooting. The theme of it is
did you have a lot of trouble shooting around the memorial? Like, do you have to get permits?
Especially tourists and stuff, right?
Yeah, we have permits for everything, and we did pay everybody. It's not like anybody worked for
right,
free,
right.
But we did a lot of everybody did it for like a very nominal
right.
price, and a lot of it was the deferred payment. Like, you know, I'll pay me later if and when the movie makes money. So a lot of that is taken.
I just imagine it'd be very tricky to shoot down there and get what you wanted to get.
Especially with a one camera
especially on 9/11, how probably crazy it is down there, I would imagine.
Sometimes I look at the film and I'm like, how did we do this?
Just you telling me the logistics of it just seemed like a nightmare.
Yeah, no, it was, but somehow it worked. Like,
how many cameras did you run when you were down there?
It was just one.
Just one? Wow.
I said the whole movie was one, right?
Just one camera?
Wow. That's what I'm saying. It's like, dude, if you don't get your shot, you're shit out of luck.
Or in the wrong position to get that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
My cinematographer, Philip Fiesenbichler, I've used him from since college. We went to school together. And he's pretty much a genius with the camera. And he's an artist. So, you know, at the beginning in the summer when my project in Mexico fell through, I was determined to make this movie no matter what. When I was going to do it with, like, the actors from the Susan Batson studio, sorry.
It's all right. Eddie, you okay?
I'm sorry. I'll recover.
Don't hit our host.
I'm going to make a movie about it.
So,
sorry.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
What camera did you use?
I was going to go into that. So I was going to use, like, just a small camera myself. Shoot it with the actors from the Susan Batson studio, who I've met when I was training there.
Right.
And when we wrote the script, James and I, and then with the help of another writer, Sinead Daly, that was an assistant writer in Blue Bloods, at the show Blue Bloods, my friends started to find out that I was making a movie in the summer, like Philip meeting one of them. He lives in Los Angeles. And he's like, "Oh, send me the script." And he's like, "Why are you? This script is great. Like, what are you going to tell me?" I'm like, "Well, because I can't pay you to come.
Right, 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 right.
You know, I can't fly you in." He's like, "No. I'm gonna do this for deferred payment. Like, don't pay me. Pay me later. Whatever. I'll bring my camera. He has a red camera, like the
oh wow,
the best red camera. I can't keep up with it.
Yeah, it changes
cameras,
every 2 minutes.
But exactly. But he had like the best, and he has his own lenses. So he's like, "I'll come and I'll bring my assistant." Gunner, who also was going to be paid the deferred payment. And then Sebastian Zurita was the same thing. He's like, "Oh, dude, are you making a movie about Nani?" Send me the script. He found out somehow. And I sent him a script, like, "Why didn't you tell me? And I love this character. And I'll give you this amount of money. And I'll come on up." So suddenly, like, the movie started to become bigger and bigger, and more budget started to come in. A friend from Spain.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. You start getting money and not you weren't asking for it.
Yeah.
Like, that's...
It was,
the,
it
not
was,
the way it works.
It was literally like that. And
that's never the way it works.
And I think that the reason that happened and the reason
it's well, it speaks to the script and the story.
The script and the subject is...
That's what the story is.
Well, I know, but I mean, like, 9/11, I mean, the story is about 9/11, but it's also about, it's so much deeper.
It's just nuts that you just put it out there and all this money started coming in for.
We had nothing and then suddenly we had an actual budget. Like, we can work. I mean, it was ridiculously low, but we can still work with it. Right?
But going from $0 to whatever it was is, yeah.
Yeah.
What was your biggest obstacle with just doing a one-camera shoot for the whole movie?
I'll be honest, I've never done a two-camera shoot.
Use one camera, but I felt like if you're, like, down there at 9/11, that's so chaotic, well, you'd want to have, like, three cameras running just so you make sure you get everything you wanted. But
I mean, we spent the day doing just walking around the place and following him. You know, it wasn't... I don't think that there was a need for...
Really?
And we didn't really know what we were going to get, you know? So we were just walking around finding things. Like, he would bump into people that would want to say hi to him and shoot them and then ask them, can we use you in the film? It's actually a film. It's not a documentary. Because people were thinking it was a documentary, you know? What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. Well, anyways, yeah. So that's... It is a miracle how it happened. So the reason I think people started to jump in, besides the story or the theme, I think is because... I decided to make the movie no matter what. And this is also something that for film, for any artist, I think, like, a lot of people will tell you no, you know? And everybody...
Everyone tells you no.
Everybody was telling me no. They were like, you're crazy. You're not going to be able to do this. You're not... But I was like, you know, then watch me, you know? And the minute they see, oh, this is actually happening, they started to jump in the bandwagon.
Yeah.
And I felt like that about this project and that I had to do it no matter what because... There was something about James being in, you know, he was so in on his talent, his compassion, and his compassion for these firefighters, the story that he was trying to get out, the theme of the post-traumatic stress, that I was like, we have to tell the story. It's amazing. We have to tell the story. Wow. And now that it's coming full circle, showing it to the firefighters, it's becoming a beautiful thing.
I wanted to ask you, like 9/11 for you is probably different than most people that were in New York. How did you bridge the gap once you were there filming? Like, how did that feel for you? Kind of being an outsider at some point, and then you were like an insider being... we're from the United States, or we've been in New York on the 9/11, you know, memorial, but never on 9/11, on the actual day. So that, like, gives you, like, this inside experience that not many people ever get.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was not in 9/11, there at 9/11.
Thought you were shooting. No, I mean...
On the
anniversary.
And then the anniversary. For me, it was just humbling. The whole experience was extremely humbling. On the last week of shooting, and we were shooting the opening film, we shot it at the end of the production. That day, I went to get my citizenship, and I became a United States citizen.
Whoa.
So I was sworn into, you know...
I got chills. This is crazy. It's awesome.
And I went to shoot the opening scene, which is when they pull him out of the rubble. And there was like this sense of like belonging to this new country and becoming part of it.
That's amazing.
Of the conversation and the citizenship. It was pretty, pretty, pretty.
That's
surreal.
Powerful.
It was surreal. Yeah.
Let's play the trailer. I want to hear this.
All right. Here we go.
74th floor. No smoke or fire problem. The walls are breached. So be careful. All right, 10-4, Ronald.
The building has collapsed.
You survived.
I didn't ask to survive.
Why did you kill all those innocent people? Why did you let them die? Why didn't you just let me die?
110 stories came down on the top of us, and we survived. What are the odds, huh?
Get out of my way! Get out of my way!
I'm not the hero that everyone thinks I am.
You inspired so many people, man. So many people.
Do what you want with the picture. You'd be doing me a favor.
He's been off the job for a year.
Getting drunk, feeling sorry for himself.
Get out of my life!
I don't want people to thank me. I didn't do anything.
I went there for you. Don't be too proud to ask for help, Dad.
I don't care if I have to live my life like a lie. Just as long as my son is proud of me.
Don't you get it? We'll always be proud of you.
We owe it to those who died to live our life to the fullest.
All
was awesome, man.
Wow.
Check it out. Check it out. Check it out.
I know none of you guys could see that, but it looks really good, like visually.
Thank you.
Looks really good. I mean, I know you said it was low budget, but you could not tell. I mean, it does look like a multi-million-dollar film.
And Eddie's got the screen, but it sounded cool too, the way it moved. You know what I mean? It's like, for me, like, I like hearing stories. That's the part of being storytellers, I think. It goes back to that, hearing a story.
If
it pulls you in, yeah.
And he was you were dealing with beard issues and shaved.
Yes, that was...
It takes some organizing.
Yeah.
Because once you shave it, you can't go back.
And he had a rare, I mean, actually, that beard he got, I think, in a month and a half, which was very, very strange for me.
That's an impressive month and a half beard. Yeah.
Exactly.
Why was it important to talk about the guilt, remorse?
I think that because nobody talks about it. I think every story you hear about 9/11 is the hero, the heroism, hero. I don't think people talk about people that are suffering from survival guilt, post-traumatic stress. I mean, of all the prescription drugs that are prescribed to these firefighters because they're having anxiety, the alcoholism, the holes in the walls, the broken families. It is a severe subject that nobody approaches because it's like, oh no, it's the hero, the heroism, the statue,
Yeah.
And it's important. I think it's important. The minute you make somebody a hero, it's also in a way you're dehumanizing. You're running the risk of dehumanizing and thinking that they're not human, that they cannot, that they don't need your help.
Right.
They don't need our help.
Yeah.
They don't need our support. John Feel, the founder of the Feel Good Foundation, is fighting for that specific reason, because a lot of people are left behind. Like, he helped pass this Zadroga bill, which helps people that are with these illnesses. I mean, it took 10 years.
I know, it's ridiculous.
For that bill to pass. How can you not?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it drives me insane.
Welcome to America.
It really drives me insane.
It's crazy the way
think about it.
They don't take care of we don't take care of the people we're supposed to take care of.
Yeah, crazy. And it's like in the movie Michael Moore did Sicko.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that was following around.
He was a first responder.
He was a first responder, and he couldn't get health care.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy to me. And we don't hear those stories. The media doesn't want us to know that kind of stuff, and that's the human story that connects us.
Exactly.
What I mean? So I love that. I was interested because. I was first interested in having you on the show because of the subject matter, not because it was 9/11, but because exactly what, it was like that survivor's remorse that, that a lot of people we don't know how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't know how to deal with that.
And the first thing is to acknowledge that it exists.
I think
that we're for the first time, we're starting to talk about the existence of this, which is a medical, not being considered a medical issue, like a severe, like a real thing, and it's not just about popping, like prescribing, Zoloft or whatever, whatever it is.
Yeah.
We need to have it, take that into account. I don't know how, but at least to be able to talk about it is a first step. And this movie is I directed it, but now it's gone beyond that. Like, now I hope that it becomes a conversation piece that sparks a conversation about firefighters and what they're going through now.
Well, I mean, they attribute a lot of, post-traumatic stress. I mean, it's always attributed to soldiers and veterans coming back from war. But, something like that experience is something a lot of soldiers in war wouldn't even experience. I mean, people that serve in the military wouldn't experience something as catastrophic as what happened on 9/11 and what some of those firefighters probably experienced and had to see and deal with. And then we don't treat them as such. We go, oh, they're heroes. They went and they saved people. But, with veterans coming back, we don't treat them as well as we should either, but we kind of we understand what post-traumatic stress is for them, but we don't really think that would happen with a fireman. I mean, even someone who didn't have the 9/11 experience, just a regular fire person going into a building and saving a human being and maybe not being able to save that person, that's going to affect them. So I don't think we'd attribute post-traumatic stress to a lot of these people that help us every day, firefighters, police officers, and such like that,
So. I got to ask, too. It's like you probably had a response from first responders, from people that were actually experiencing some of those same emotions. Talk a little bit about that. I want to know, what kind of response you've gotten from people that were there.
Sure. In the beginning, when we were making the film, it was important for us to pitch the idea to firefighters and see what the response they would have. And it was very interesting because we did like a little bit of a sizzle reel, like a kind of like a Kickstarter, but not really. Like, we didn't put it out. It was just more for to recruit friends and family that, or you know, to help us.
Right. Please save this movie.
Yeah, like, please come and help us. And to also, it was a way for me to like see how the movie would feel, how I wanted it to feel. Like, it was more like a director's treatment of the film. But when we took it to the firehouse, took two firehouses, one in Queens and one in downtown New York. And the response was mixed. It was like some people were like, some firemen were like, yeah, that's exactly right. That I'm so glad that you're doing a movie about this. That when I go up into a building, I always think about my family. And sometimes I don't even go. Because right. Like, and people say tell me like, that's your job, you have to go up there. But you know, sometimes it's the truth. I'm scared. Yeah. Obviously, I'm scared. Like,
right.
I don't want to go up. I don't know if I'm going to come down.
Right.
You know, I don't know. And other people like you don't talk about that. You know, that's disrespectful. You know, we tried to get the fire department involved in the very beginning to lend us.
Well, that's when you know you're on the right path of the movie. When someone's like, you don't talk about that. Like, well, no, this needs to be made then.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was really scary because I was carrying my laptop to the firehouses and like, suddenly, like, you press play and you don't know, like, there's this, like,
yeah.
You know, there's a guy.
That's like the worst audience ever to, like, I mean, like.
Especially for your first response. Like,
well, usually if you're screening a film, you're in the back of a dark theater and you just run out the back door.
Yeah, right.
There you're like, you got to close your laptop and then walk out. And,
yeah. Well, and it's such a delicate subject.
Yeah,
right.
It's crazy.
Delicate, but it was very important to, like, before we do the film, to know, you know, where the people stand, whether it was good or bad. And you know, when in the firehouse in downtown, it was the same thing, same kind of response. Like, yeah, I don't know if you should do that. We called in fire department. We tried to get equipment from them for the movie, props, wardrobe. They're like, no, we don't want to be involved in this movie. Like, they were like very tough on it. Like, no, there's no way we're getting involved. And like, we're very pretty much you know, bad about it. Mad about it. But now that the movie's done, and I've shared it with, I mean, John Field, who's shared it on his Facebook, like, the response has been, like, shared, like, I think, like, 30 times by firefighters, who are like, that's exactly, I'm so glad somebody's talking about
it. Wow, that's like, got to make you feel great.
Oh, it felt like I'm in heaven right now. Like, I feel so blessed that I was had the opportunity to make the movie,
right.
You know? I'm so humbled by the response, and to see the first responders. One thing to like, I've gotten first responders from Albany emailing me like, can you come here and screen the movie here? From other places that were came down, from Indiana, I got an email from Indiana. You know, so for a long time I didn't know what the movie was gonna become. I didn't know what the movie was gonna be, and now it's becoming clearer and clearer that more like it's a reminder of the passion that we had when we started the film. Because when you go into the editing, you kind of go into this process and into this tunnel that like you don't know when you're going to come out. And at the end, you're tired.
Isn't that funny? Like, we make art not knowing how it's going to react, but you get so focused on finishing it. But when you see why, it's like that's what makes it the most rewarding, more than anything.
Is the final cut of your film, did it turn out pretty much the way the script was? Did you have any major changes that you did that you found in editing where it took the story differently than what the script had originally intended, or you pretty much went?
No. Well, the only thing that changed in the editing was removing a couple of scenes in the first act that I realized that we had a scene, for instance, like a great scene, two scenes, great scenes in a jail, because you know, the character ended up in jail. But we were going to go to New Jersey to shoot in this jail. I was like, hold on, like we're going to shoot this minor scene in the jail. We're going to go out there just to shoot this. Like, so I kind of wrote a couple of other scenes to shoot while we're there. And they had meaning, and it was important to shoot those scenes. But like, when you see the final cut, you realize you have to get to the story faster.
Yeah.
And those scenes like pained me so much because it was very good acting as well. And I had to
You had to get there and shoot it.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't serve the story, then you got to...
Yeah, it served the story. It's just like it took too long for the story to take off. And it's one of those things that where you have to drown your babies for the sake of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to come up with a better term than that.
Yeah. Kids, don't drown your babies.
It's a horrible term.
It's been making its debut at a couple film fests. Talk a little bit about that and how that has been for your movie and the support of the movie.
Sure. So it premiered internationally at the Fuji Film Festival. In Italy, it's 30 minutes away from Rome. It's a beautiful festival. Unfortunately, my connection I missed my connection because of the flight was delayed.
Didn't get to go there.
I went there. I got there, but I got there the day after, and I was so depressed.
That sucks.
I was like, I can't believe it. Like, I had to change. I had to fly to Amsterdam, then from Amsterdam.
And that was the world premiere, technically.
That was the world
premiere. Oh, that sucks.
But you know, when I got there, my mom was there, and she told me, yeah, it was. It was good. People liked it, you know. But I was like, I didn't know.
Your mom was here. Your mom is here right now.
She doesn't want to talk. But yeah, she was there.
She'll tell us after what the reaction was. That's awesome.
Yeah, and she was in the movie too. She has a couple of scenes, three scenes, I think, in the movie.
That's awesome.
So my mom was like, oh, it was good. The reaction was good, but I didn't know. But the next day, they organized a Q&A with me the day after, and they told everybody that, you know, that what happened. Like, I missed that flight. And so the next day, I find myself on the stage with people that had seen my movie the prior day, and the theater is pretty much like full.
That's awesome.
And they're asking me questions, and they're Italian, right? So they're asking me in Italian, and they're translating, and I'm like, these people actually watch my movie.
You're like, my name is Jorge. Yeah, I'm
that's
not
crazy.
It was insane. Like,
that's awesome.
It was the first time that I had shown the movie without, but I wasn't there to show the movie, right? So I didn't know what the reaction was, and so I found out through the questions that they actually like loved the film, and they gave me a little award for the bravery of doing this film and talking about the subject. And but I still, like, you know, I really didn't believe the juries gave me a lot of feedback about there was the juries of some Princeton and greater universities that came to give feedback. But I was like still like not really knowing what was going on. And then a week after, we went to Rhode Island, and it was the U.S. premiere in the Rhode Island International Film Festival. And there, finally, I was able to, for the first time, to watch the film with an audience. And I was with my girlfriend at that moment, and everybody behind me was crying.
Wow!
Everybody at the end, like, asking tons of questions, asking me, "Can I take a picture with you?" Like, it was so important.
Wow!
Like, you know, tearing up, and I was like, oh wow! The movie works.
That's amazing.
Good. I did my job.
That's amazing.
But it was.
That's the best feeling. That's the best feeling. Were you nervous, even though you had that response in Italy and you didn't get to experience it? Were you nervous about the first time you actually experienced the reaction and response?
Yeah, because one is an international audience,
right?
And the other one is a U.S. audience. And this next Sunday is going to be the firefighter audience, which is like extremely targeted, right? To like to the people that the movie was meant to be made for, right? To be told, a movie that honors them, so which is going to be another incredible experience. I was very surprised. I was nervous when I felt the people like reacting to the film. I was like, oh wow, they're in. And then I was watching it was as if I was watching the film for the first time as an audience.
Yeah, you're experiencing it through them. It's amazing.
And I had never had that feeling since college, or actually short films or something. It was an incredible, and that rush made me want to make another film. Like,
right.
You know, it was for the first time I felt like I need to make another film now.
Well, talk a little bit about your previous movies. Like, they were so different than what this project was, and how you used that experience to kind of accomplish your goals in this film.
Sure. My first film was Hotel Chelsea. It's a horror film. It's a thriller. Actually, funny enough, my first two films were not my films per se. They were films by producers who hired me to direct, which is very rare, because like normally you make your own film and you make your own script. I was very lucky, very blessed to have had the chance to direct for somebody else, for a production company. The first film was a Japanese production that came to New York. I was looking for a director, and they hired me. Somebody recommended me, a friend of mine recommended me, Sonia Juan. And they hired me to direct the film. So I kind of learned by being in other productions. And the second film, You Can't Kill Stephen King, was a similar situation. They hired me to shoot the movie as a cinematographer. Sometimes I shoot too. And it was two actors that wrote the script, because they were tired of not getting casted
in films. I know that feeling.
And
I write.
But it was very inspiring to see these actors, and I always tell actors the same thing. Like, you have now, especially with the technology and people that are passionate, Los Angeles is full of them, you know.
Yeah.
Full of us, passionate people, artists that want to do great work, and that often don't get the chance or get typecasted or whatever it is, right? And so Ronnie Khalil and Monroe Mann, who were starring and co-wrote the story, hired me to shoot it. They were gonna direct it. Once we were on set, they realized that it was a big job to direct and act in your movie.
Yeah.
And so they asked me to co-direct with them. So that's how that happened. So I stepped up to help them direct the movie. But it wasn't my project per se. But it ended up being a very fun experience, and I watch it with a lot of love when I see it. Small film, super small film.
And you recall the wrestling matches you had with the actors that you're like, no, we're gonna shoot it like this.
Well, that's the beautiful thing. Like when it's three people, then if you have this agreement, there's always a third one to break the tie, right? So that it's better than co-directing with that one person.
Yeah, then you're locked in.
And how did that give you like the confidence to just take on this? Because this is, I mean, that's such a delicate subject.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially if you're doing a horror movie and then you're doing another kind of, twisted kind of thriller, I guess.
Yeah.
And then this is something totally serious, totally dramatic, delicate on every level. Just on national pride versus, heroes, pride also versus just vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So how did that affect your confidence into going into this project, like, I can do this and do it full justice?
Yes. The first film gave me confidence in my directing abilities, that I can make a film, that I can, like, envision a film, storyboard a film, tell a film compellingly. And I had never done that in a feature scale level. The second film gave me the confidence that I can actually produce films myself, because these two actors were so inspiring to they put the whole thing together. They spend like extreme, like almost nothing. And we shot it with a still camera, with a 5D. And so I realized that I can make a movie, that I don't need to go asking people for help, or I don't have to take no for an answer. They didn't take no for an answer. And that was very inspiring. So what made me confident about telling a serious, very dramatic film was really going and studying with Susan Batson.
Mm.
That's really what... It made me aware that to not be afraid of my own feelings and my own emotions, which as an artist you have to really dive in. And when James proposed this story to me, there was really two options: say no because I'm scared of the drama, or head on, hit it and go after it.
Yeah.
And I chose to do the latter, thankfully.
Nice. Well, the world's a better place because you did that.
That's right. And where can people find the movie, or where is it being released?
So the screening, we haven't had an official release date yet. We're making promotions. I want to share with as many firefighters as I can. Like, this weekend is going to be big for us. And we have a couple of offers from distributors. We have a sales agent as well that we screened at Cannes, Berlin, and everything.
That's awesome.
But it's a delicate subject, and sometimes distributors are iffy, and they don't know if they will find an audience because of the subject matter can be taken as heavy. But
there's always an audience. That's the one thing that distributors should understand. Like, get out of the business aspect and know that if it's well done, there's an audience for it.
And it's a beautiful film. Like, meaning it's not the it's uplifting. It's inspiring. It's not a movie that it's depressing. It's definitely dark in the beginning, but the character is a redemption story, so it has a beautiful message as well.
Fantastic.
Good stuff.
Man, I'm moved. I want to watch it. I'm ready, Eddie. What I like a lot about it is it's just such a different perspective on 9/11. And you're right, like, you don't see anything in the media like it. What do you think was the character's biggest obstacle when you were filming, just to get into that place? Because not being in that experience, that's got to be just a ridiculous way to just jump into it. You know, never having been at the 9/11 memorial, never having been a part of the experience, to just jump into that character. What do you think was the biggest obstacle for him to get in that character?
I think the biggest obstacle was in most independent films, is the shooting conditions. Because sometimes, because of budget, you don't get the time to prep,
it's so on the fly.
Sometimes, you have to get this other angle, and you have to jump from this to this, and you don't get as many takes. You're shooting many pages per day. We didn't have the money to shoot in a relaxed manner that allows for creativity to fully.
Yeah, you're like, let's play around with this take.
right. Yeah. The great thing is that James is, being the actor that he is, was in character all the time, and the rest of the actors had just to go and talk to him, really. And every actor that we got was really marvelous. We lucked out because the performances are amazing from everyone involved. C.C. Lockhart, which is plays the mother of Gus in the film, amazing. Kelly O'Grady, Sebastián Zurita, Ernest. All the actors were... We were very, very, very lucky to get the actors that we got. Incredible. And Carl Ford, of course, the main antagonist. Incredible actor.
That's awesome. I can't wait to see it. What's next for you? After you do the touring of this movie, what's another project that you're looking to do? Or are you kind of just like, I want to ride this wave as long as I can take it and not even thinking about something else?
No, on the contrary. I think making this movie inspires me to... being in the... In the showcase part of the movie, inspires me to make the next one because,
right.
Like I said, like if you're in the editing room, you don't know. Like you're a musician, you get instant gratification from the audience, right? And that's what the moment that I'm in right now of getting feedback.
You
from
deserve
the
it. All the hard work is paying off now.
Thank you. And so now it's like, oh, I'm getting excited to make another one and share another story with people. So I'm working. I'm finishing a script that I've been writing for a few years about love and jealousy, and that's. Personal, very personal story that about and I'm being like crying every day writing it. And I'm in that process of like spilling my guts into the thing, and it's been great. At the same time, I'm helping a director. Actually, one of the co-directors, Ronnie Khalil of the You Can't Kill Stephen King movie,
right.
Did a movie last year in Greece. Called With a Kiss I Die, and he asked me to shoot it to be the cinematographer of it. And I went with it because it was really, really fun. And my girlfriend, Ella Kweku, starring in it. And I was like, well, I'm not going to let you go to Greece alone.
Smart man.
Which was another, this is like another story. But now we're finishing that. He's finishing the movie now, and he's in the final stages of post-production, and I'm helping him just do another final pass on the film before we go into color grade and sound design and all that.
That's amazing.
Cool.
Well, Jorge Valdeziga.
Thank you for coming by.
Jorge Fernando Valdeziga.
Fernando.
Oh, I love it. We expect great things. We'd love to have you back. You are an amazing guest.
Thank you so much.
Man.
And the name of the film one more time.
I was there.
And all right. You were too, Eddie.
We all were.
We'll see you guys next week.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.